This is Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane.
Hi, I'm Cathy Van Extel, filling in for Emma Griffiths, who's taking a well-earned break. I'm very excited to be spending the week with you, and I have to fess up that it's been a good while since I've been on local radio, so you're going to have to forgive me if I'm a bit rusty. So, how closely have you been following the events in Thailand? It's a monumental international operation to save the 16 boys and their coach who were trapped in a flooded cave. And as a parent, you can only imagine just what the kids and their parents are going through right now. Wasn't it great to wake up this morning to the news that four of the boys have been saved? It's an extraordinary feat. It took them 8 hours. They had to scuba dive through narrow passages and then climb and walk through difficult cave terrain. And if ever a child needed resilience and inner strength, it's now in that cave. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. How do you raise independent children, especially when the odds are stacked against you in our risk-averse society? Perhaps you're happy to raise a free-range child, but how do you overcome the barriers that have been put in place in the name of safety? You're probably also up against time pressures. And then there are the attitudes of others, especially other parents. Maybe you're a parent who wants to keep a close eye on your child to protect them from any potential harm, whether it's physical or emotional. Maybe you want to help them to protect them from failure or make sure that they're winners to get ahead in life. How structured is your child's life? Is it filled with sport, dance lessons, music lessons, social engagements? And how much time does your child spend inside as opposed to outside? I'd love to hear from you today. The number to call is 1300 222 612. That's 1300 222 612, or you can SMS on 0467 922 612. Love to hear from you. How do you make a more independent child, and how do you get around some of the hurdles that we face these days? Let me introduce my guest today. Hayano Moser is the program manager of Nature Play Queensland. It's a fancy title for someone who gets to think about really fun things for kids to do outside, things like getting really muddy. Now, I'm not sure how muddy Rachel Sharman gets at the University of Sunshine Coast. She's a psychologist with a specialty in child and adolescent development, and she has a pretty good understanding of why playing in the mud is good for us. Welcome to you both.
Thanks. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Hayano, let's start with your personal story. It's an interesting one. For your own kids, you're a father of four, you set out to find a neighbourhood that would allow them to grow up in the same kind of way that you did, and that is outside. What was the criteria?
Other children. That is was the driving criteria. I mean, we picked an area that was quite natural because we wanted to live out in nature, but yeah, when it got down to it, we were tossing up between a fair few houses, and we could have bought one that was very fancy, very new, and had an incredible 270-degree view up on perched up on top of this hill. But we chose not to. We chose the older house. It was surrounded by children, and we moved into this neighbourhood. When we moved into this neighbourhood, it was we could have been up on the top of that hill. We would have isolated our kids, and that for us was a priority not to let that happen.
So was the key criteria having children around, or yes, was it also the environment?
Both. Yeah. So we chose a house that was in an area that was quite natural, quite open. The traffic was low, and yeah, we knew there was lots of kids. The day we moved in our moving truck, because my daughter Lily, she's nine, she's listening right now. Hi, Lily. She bugged me as soon as we parked the removal truck to go and introduce her to these children who were next door, and we did just that. We went around, knocked on the door and introduced the kids, and they've been playing ever since.
And what way do they play then? Because, you know, you can know the kid next door but go into their room or their lounge room and play on the screen all day.
Yeah, well, their play is directed by them. They choose what they do. I found, actually, if I cut straight to the chase, the best thing as a parent that I could do to ensure my children are independent is get out of their way of being independent. And that's what we've done. Lily is the biggest director of her own play. Her last thought before she goes to sleep at night is, what are we going to do tomorrow? What games am I going to play? Who am I going to get to play? How am I going to get to convince these kids to play these games? And she's got the whole plan of the next day mapped out, especially during the school holidays. Right.
But how much time does she spend outside then?
All day. Yeah. There from 8 a.m., we don't let her go any earlier. She would go earlier if we let her, but we let the neighbours sleep till 8.
I mean, it's all very well in theory, I think, to go look for a neighbourhood if you can afford it and look for somewhere where there's lots of kids. I mean, we're not all in that position where we can pick and choose where we live. But I also wonder, you're also not in a situation where you can dictate what other parents do with their kids and allow their kids to do.
No, and it hasn't been smooth sailing. It's taken years, actually, and it's still building. Like, we've been there 4 years now, and we're still building the trust between the parents as well as the kids and their capacity to get around the neighbourhood independently. It's been a journey, and it didn't happen instantaneously. And I think, actually, it really took 2 years to develop its own intrinsic motivation in the kids, doing it for themselves consistently every day and valuing it so strongly. Like, they really have them. We could ground our kids and it means something. You know, we wouldn't have to take the iPads off them. The most valuable thing that our kids have at the moment is their outdoor play.
Well, that's a feat in itself in this day and age. Rachel, could I bring you in here? Rachel Sharman, why is it so important that children have outside play for their development?
We're actually still trying to understand this from a research perspective. So there's been quite a lot of work done looking at nature and how it helps with just human development, not only child development. It probably started in 1984 when Roger Ulrich published an interesting finding that people in hospital beds facing nature got quicker better, asked for less pain medication, rehabilitated more effectively than those in bricks and mortar. So since then, researchers have been running around sort of scrambling, trying to figure out what is going on here. Why do we seem to have this intrinsic connection with getting outside, actually working outside, and how is that benefiting us? And I suppose some of the really exciting stuff done from the child perspective is looking at actual brain changes. So we're getting really fancy now with MRI research and looking at the differences between the way brains develop if kids are playing outside, and it has to be an outdoor green space. You cannot replicate this. This is what's really fascinating. If you shove them in an old master's warehouse that's got a great gym in it, doesn't work. Has to be an outdoor green space. There's something that the outdoors is offering that cannot be substituted. It cannot be faked. And the way a child's brain grows and adapts to that seems to just be just full of positives. You name it, it's better. There's also some basic stuff. You mentioned earlier about failure. The one wonderful thing about nature is no workplace health and safety consultant has come along and said those rocks must be 30 centimetres apart and this tree must be at this angle and yada yada. You have to adapt to it. You have no other choice. If you want to climb that tree, you've got to figure it out. And you can just imagine the cognitive work going on there, so the learning work, but also, a bit of that self-assessment. Hey, do I have the skills to do this? Can I actually manage that? Should I call for help? Should I get some buddies in? How do I actually approach this? Do I need some social support? Do I need others around me, or can I do this myself? And if you do fail, heaven forbid, should you fall out of the tree, you're actually getting quite a lot of learning going on there as well. What did I do wrong? What do I need to do next time? And the big one that people forget is emotional regulation. No one likes to fail. No one likes to fall out of trees. How are you going to manage your own emotions when you actually do that? And this is what kids are learning when they're playing outdoors with other children and, developing not only really great sort of cognitive learning skills as well as physical, that's obvious, but also that emotional and psychological resilience as well.
So there's a lot going on there. You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane, and today we're asking the question, how do you encourage your children to be independent? I'd love to hear from you. What sort of things do you allow your children to do, and what do you encourage of your children to build that resilience and that independence and get them outside, away from those screens. The number is 1300 222 612, or you can SMS us on 0467 922 612. Just a quick question, Rachel, before we go to Irene, who's called in from Kingston. Can you tell me, are there any statistics around how much time Aussie kids now play outside versus inside?
Look, I think Hiano's the one who's very good at quoting this, but I think at the moment we play out, our kids play outdoors less than maximum security prisoners, if I'm not incorrect. Hiano, perhaps you could comment on that.
Yeah, we do have our kids under a polite form of household arrest. Yeah, and there's actually research done in 2012, looked at around 4,000 kids, and what they did over a two-week period, they looked at all their recreational choices and activities, what they did with their leisure time. 7.4% of those kids played outside every day.
7.4.
Yep, that's it.
And if that's a change, what, in a generation, really?
One generation. If you look, there's Planet Ark did some great research on that. They looked at how much time our generation, most people probably 30 up, spent outdoors. And it was, we spent 73% of our time outdoors more than indoors, versus now it's 13%. So that's a 60% cultural shift in the change in a way that our kids are playing. And that's going to have an impact on their health and well-being.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? I'd like to hear from Irene. She's called in from Kingston. Hi, Irene.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Now, you have some independent grandchildren.
I have the most amazingly independent grandchildren, and it's my daughter's credit that that's happened. Now, I've got three daughters, so we're brought up to be independent, you know. They go and play. I'll call you when dinner's ready. And they're on their 40s, but my youngest daughter especially, she lives at Alchester, and she's got older people across the road about my age, and she's had some kids as well in the neighbourhood. But since her boys were toddlers, they've always loved to go and visit the older people across the road too. And she'd walk them to the edge, and she'd let the neighbours know they wanted to come and visit. And she'd walk them to the edge and tell them to look for traffic, then go, you can go and see Terry and Anne. And then they'd go over there, and they'd have cup of tea outside, and they'd have something to eat, and they'd play with their ball with them, and then they'd bring them back, and they'd say, we've had a visit, and they'd go to the neighbours, and they'd tell them all what they did.
That's wonderful, isn't it? So there's social elements to that, as well as the physical being outside.
Some of the key ingredients.
And the boys now, they're teenagers, they're 13 and 15, her two boys, and they have found a little creek not far from where they live, and when the cousins come over, they all just get their fishing rods and off they go, and they walk down to the creek and take some food and drink and sit down there and fish, never catch anything, but they have a chat.
Irene, well, that's an inspiration for us. It is possible in this day and age. Thanks for calling in.
You know what? The parents have to stop hovering. My daughter said to me, they can't believe how people hover over their kids and want to keep controlling their play. Parents and grandparents have to stop controlling play. They come to my place, I've got big trees, they climb them, they chop off branches that I don't want chopped, don't care. They can do what they like.
No helicopters in your backyard, Irene.
Not for me.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
While we're talking then about helicopter parenting, I'd like to pick up on a call from Brenda in Indooroopilly. Hi, Brenda. Hello, Brenda. Oh, we might get back to Brenda if she's there. She's concerned.
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi, Brenda.
Yes, sorry, maybe it's not a terribly good line.
No, we're great. Brenda, you're calling in because of concern about children who do get injured, that there are injuries.
That's right. I think it needs to be balanced a bit. I have known of a particular situation where this happened, where the parents, quite reasonably, as I did, good children, encouraged them to be independent. As you said, sort of climbing trees, they fall out. Excuse me, sorry, that they perhaps learn a lesson from that and what to do next time. But I do know of a child who fell out and was brain damaged. Now, I mean, we do need some sort of balance that can be the cost of letting children be independent and encouraging them to make decisions on their own and what they want to do. There's no easy solution to this, but sometimes just saying, you know, let your children go out, be independent, test themselves, there can be awful consequences. So I just thought I would put that in as perhaps a bit of a balance.
No, I'm very glad to hear your call, Brenda, and it's a very good point to make, and I'd like to bring Hayano and Rachel in at this point. Hayano, you're nodding.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a devastating story to for that family and that child. And these cases happen. You know, kids do get injured, and these are the risks of letting our kids go out and play, but there are also risks associated, long-term risks, health risks, associated with not letting our kids go out and play. And these can be far greater in the long term, you know. And it is unfortunate that we do get these cases where kids do get seriously injured. But those anomalies, they're not the norm and they're not the majority. And, you know, while nobody wants their child to be the one, I don't think any one of us want our kids to have long-term health issues as well that are associated with having indoor sedentary lifestyles, which is this indoor growing childhood trend, which is a real risk that's becoming quite widespread.
Rachel, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really important point. They are anomalies. And in fact, there was some wonderful New Zealand research that where a school banned playground rules. And you know what? There were injuries when they had rules and there were injuries when they got rid of rules. The injuries when they got rid of them were lower. Okay, so we just need to, so statistics are fine and these anomalies are fine, but in fact, when they actually gave children the responsibility themselves to start assessing their own risk, to take responsibility for their own health and safety, to develop those physical skills, the injury rate drops. So yeah, you're going to have injuries either way. Whether you have structured play or unstructured play, it would appear the injury rate is lower in unstructured play.
You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane. Today we're talking about how you create and mould independent children, creating, I guess, a resilience in them and an ability to get on with life independently. The number to call, if you'd like to call us, is 1300 222 612. If you've got a story to share, perhaps you've got children of your own and find it difficult to free range them the way that we're being encouraged to for their mental health. The number 1300 222 612, also SMS on, if I can find the number, I'll get it back to you shortly. But the moment is Britt, who's been waiting very patiently on the line. Britt?
Yeah, that's...
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay.
What are your thoughts?
Well, kind of like it's a balancing act in terms of you have to be present, really present to your children and support them. I think you don't just sort of like send them out there and tell them to spread their wings when they're not ready to spread their wings, but then also don't over control them as well, which disallows them. So it's about like working really closely with your children, feeling them and being really present to them, so that and not have. Because when we've got so much fear, then we're wrapping our arms around them, controlling them, and then they can't go out and spread their wings and explore and be independent. So it's kind of it's really about ourselves and feeling into when we've got fear, and they can feel that too, and then creating that safe, energetic, and physical environment for them to go and self explore and. Become independent, which takes years.
Britt, you're a mum of four, and I know you've encouraged your children to do things for themselves since they were tiny. But is it about sort of not a one case fits all? It's about understanding each child and what they can do.
Yeah, and it's about ourselves as parents as well. It's because they come from us. So, and then what we've got. In ourselves, our fears and our concerns, they pick that up, and that then affects how comfortable and safe they feel to navigate the world as well.
That's a great point, Britt. Sorry.
The
messages that we send our children are just as important. The ones that, you know, if we do send our kids messages of fear about their communities, they will be fearful.
And
that'll breed fear in our children and the way that they interact with their worlds.
Yeah.
Britt, what are some of the things that your kids do now that other parents might be hesitant to let their children do?
Oh, wow. I guess my eldest is, he's 13. He's quite confident with, you know, power tools and building things. Let me think. Gosh, it's such a range. From the youngest of four, and the middle child is nine. And it's different for each child what they're confident to do, depending on what they've been exposed to in their life as well.
What about mishaps? I mean, the question was raised a little earlier about the fact that there are dangers that we need to bear in mind.
So we need to be present to our children, I think, and know when they need someone else present. If we're not able to be present, it's just not going, here, guys, go, see you later, and not knowing what they're doing or where they are.
I liken it to being called a play detective. It's like monitoring your children, keeping an eye on them and their capabilities, and looking for cues. You're going, okay, they're looking for a little bit more from their play. How as a parent can I facilitate that? And going and spending time with your children out, observing them, not necessarily not directly being involved with them.
Or controlling them, yeah.
Yeah, but observing them and their capabilities, and then going, oh, okay, they seem like they're ready to push it to the next level.
Yeah, that's it. It's a balancing act. It's not extreme in either way. It's not extremely letting go and having no presence, and it's not extremely controlling with lots of rules and regulations. It's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I see my role as a parent as a play enchanter. I look for things that I can do, like throw out little seeds into my children's play and go, oh, have you thought about this? And then they go, oh. And then off they go, and they take out and they go somewhere and they do something with
and
it.
And it's wonderful to see the products of those seeds, because they often go in an unexpected direction, which is just very inspiring for you as well. I'm going to bring in Michael Gross. Thank you very much, Britt, before I move on. Michael Gross is the author of The Spoon-Fed Generation, and he certainly thinks that we're doing far too much for our children. Michael, welcome to ABC Radio Brisbane.
Yeah, thank you very much.
What are we doing to our children with our current parenting methods that you think is problematic?
Yeah, I think we make kids too dependent on adults. And that's largely because I think we've got a little bit of a confusion about our roles as mums and dads. I guess you go back a few generations and parents intuitively try to make themselves redundant. And that's something we're pretty afraid of. And I think a lot of parents confuse redundancy with irrelevance. And so I see a lot of children at different ages who, I guess, can't do the basics of life, look after themselves.
What do you mean by looking after themselves?
Making your own lunch. You know, start from dressing yourself when you're young through to doing up shoelaces. Making your own lunch, making phone calls. Getting people to do things for you is, I guess, the opposite of that. So that very much, I guess, it's a sense of life skills. And I guess that notion of never regularly do for a child the things a child can do for him or herself. And so that's that notion of self-sufficiency and autonomy. I think we're starting to lose that to a degree.
And what's the danger of that?
Kids, Sarah... I guess you could say one of them is that kids stay around longer, but we know they're already staying around longer. But one of the dangers is
making it too comfortable for them.
When you develop independence in kids, you're developing problem solvers. And also you're developing resilient kids, because when kids start to do things for themselves, such as look after the garbage, or they're going to mess up. And when they mess up, then it can be annoying for us as parents, but it's a great learning for kids. They learn how to persist. They learn how to get around things. They learn they must do things even though it's hot or cold or wet or I've got too much homework. So they learn a lot of good character traits as well. And so sometimes we underestimate what we take away from kids when we do a little bit too much for them. They also become quite resourceful. That notion of resourcefulness is an interesting one. So a lunch list at home by a child is a problem. And in this day and age, sometimes we race up that lunch because we don't want a child to miss out or, you know, bad parents don't feed their kids is a concept there. But also that forgotten lunch is an opportunity for the child to develop their own resources, whether it's to borrow one from someone else just to miss out altogether, or sort of weasel their way in to talk to a teacher to get something, or whatever it is. But sometimes we take those problems away, and so kids become quite dependent on us as adults.
Why do you think we are doing so much more for our kids these days?
Small families. We're very busy. So sometimes it's easier for me as a parent to make my child's lunch in the morning and get them off to school, so I know it's done. Whereas...
Without as much mess.
Yeah, without as much mess as well. And I think that notion of small families impacts as well. So what we see when families get below four... and majority of Australian parents, or 52% of Australian parents, have two children or less. We tend to see our parenting as very individual. So we do things for kids. As our kids get or our families get larger, there's a tendency to do less for them. And kids, it's just, you know, physically we can't do as much if you've got five or six. So kids do more things for themselves. So what we know is that alloparenting occurs, and alloparenting is that sort of built-in system in bigger families where older siblings look after younger siblings, and, you know, they maybe make the lunch for the younger one or get them off to school in the morning. So they take on more responsibilities. And what we do know is when alloparenting occurs, they develop a whole bunch of higher level traits such as empathy and trust come through as well. So the relationships often change with kids as well.
So if you're a parent who wants to loosen up a bit, you've already got kids, say, at school age, how do you get started? Does it need to be a bit of a phased-in process?
Yeah, I think most of us are evolutionary changes rather than revolutionary changes. And, you know, that's why it's always good to get to parents when they're very young. And I've got all my children, and they now have very young children, and I'm sort of keeping an eye out, and they seem to... A lot of their language is about self-sufficiency, rather, you know, which is great. If you suddenly get to 10 or 11 and you've done everything for a child, it's sometimes hard to turn that around. So it's small changes. I always like to get kids involved in food. I think food's a basic one. So kids, you know, it's nice to be able to get kids involved in the whole food process, whether it's making your own snacks through to setting the table through to the dishwasher. Start to allocate small jobs in that way, and linking it around food is one way. And I think you need to bring kids on board with you rather than saying, right, tonight everything's going to change. You bring them on board and look for ways that they can contribute themselves.
And from my experience, I know that children really respond to this idea of becoming more independent, of being more grown up. You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane, and we've been talking to Michael Gross, who's the author of Spoon-Fed Generation. We'd like to hear from you. What sort of things are you doing at home to create independent kids in this risk-averse world? What sort of chores are your kids doing at home? Do they get themselves ready for school? Or what sort of things do they do for themselves? How are you teaching them those life skills? The number is 1300 222 612, SMS 0467 922 612. Michael, it sounds like it's going to be a bit of a slow process if you haven't been doing it from an early age, but clearly the rewards are there in the longer term.
Look, they are. I guess I like to sort of work backwards, whereas we want our kids to become independent, self-sufficient in a physical sense, also an emotional sense. So sort of work backwards. If you want your child to be able to leave home at 18, 19, you know,
I think we've lost Michael again. I think we have a little bit of a dodgy line there, but our thanks to Michael for persisting with us. Rachel, can I bring you in here? Rachel Sharman, I know you have some thoughts about creating independence, not only just in the home setting, but also around homework.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so look, I think everything that Michael said before was absolutely spot on, and I would just like to point out the difference between
helping a child acquire a skill, so skill acquisition, whether it's homework, whether it's cooking dinner, whether it's, you know, playing with a ball, and then leaving them alone for skill development. And I think that's a really nice way for parents to think about things. So I, for example, have a six-month-old baby at home, and he's learning how to eat a milk arrowroot biscuit. Now, before all the nutrition Nazis flood my inbox this morning, he's my child number five, so I officially have no standards left. So Michael's quite right there. But look, of course, at first he had to figure out how to hold the biscuit. You know, babies don't get hand and arm control until they're a few months old. But once he's actually figured out how to hold that biscuit and get it to his mouth, I then have to do the very difficult thing as a mother and leave him alone. Leave him to it. It's very tempting when he's chasing the biscuit round with the backs of his hands, because babies are hilarious when they're learning this sort of stuff, to actually help him to pick it up to give it to him. Mm. Don't. Leave him alone. I've seen him do it. He knows how to do it. Now he has to learn. And he's only going to learn by repetitive practice over and over and over again, by getting it wrong, by dropping it, by watching the dog eat it, you know, that kind of thing. So these are the sorts of things that parents need to think about, and whether it's simple stuff around how to eat a biscuit versus doing homework, by all means, as Britt was saying earlier, get involved, be present while your child needs some learning, needs some training, needs to understand how to do something. Once they've picked that up, back off, just go away, let them figure it out themselves. And by all means, you can come back in if they're having difficulty, or even if you want to teach an expert level of skill, they might actually get really good at something, and you might think, wow, he's actually so good he needs a coach, you know, like he's actually awesome at this, now we need to move him up a bit. But yeah, try to sort of think about that skill acquisition versus skill development. Once they know how to do something, let them work it out themselves.
And one thing that keeps coming up in this conversation is the importance of failing. So if they're not doing it right, let them fail and learn from that.
Absolutely. And I'm really pleased Michael talked about the emotional stuff around that, because as I said, that's what's really important. It's that problem solving for a start, which is great. Of course, we want our kids to be resourceful. We want them to problem solve. But yeah, if they've left their lunch at home and they can't figure out how to get some lunch, you know what? They're going to go hungry. They're going to have some bad feelings associated with that. They probably won't leave their lunch at home ever again. No, I can guarantee you that, because they'll learn from that bad experience. And then they're going to have to regulate themselves that afternoon when they're cranky and feeling, you know, grotty because they didn't get their lunch. Great. You know what? That's going to happen in life. There will be other times in their life, for whatever reason, they have to go without food and they still have to work or they still have to get the job done. You know, this is a very simple life lesson, and no one's going to die because they miss lunch. You know, put this into perspective.
Well, let's hear from our callers. Tracy has called in. She totally agrees with Michael. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. Yeah, I've got four as well, and definitely you can't micromanage four kids, unless I'm not superhuman, so I can't. And we have them all doing things. Number two daughter makes her own pasta. She YouTubed it and learned how to make pasta.
And how old is she, Tracy?
A pasta machine. Well, she's in grade 12 this year, but when she had a crack at it, she was year 9. So there's always been an attitude of, yeah, have a go. They like to cook, and that's a learned behaviour as well. And the little one's just out in the paddock feeding some bulls some pellets at the moment. And we have a property in the country as well, so they're all hands-on with cattle work up in the cattle yards. And I think empowering your kids rather than micromanaging and hand-holding is imperative to have fully functioning, non-codependent adults.
Great. Thanks very much, Tracy. It sounds like you've got things pretty free range at your place.
Oh, within reason.
Within reason. That's one of the, I guess, the essentials as well. Gary from Greenbank has called in. He has six children, so two more than Tracy, and a seven-year-old who does all sorts of chores. What sort of chores, Gary?
He does nearly everything for himself. He gets himself up in the morning. He goes in the shower by himself, he dresses himself, he gets his own breakfast. He actually wants to do these things, he doesn't want our help.
Is that because he's got older siblings?
Yeah, well, he's got older siblings, but they don't all live at home, and my oldest daughter's now got her own child who's only 5 months old, and she's bringing him up in the same regard. I think that all this over-parenting is just generating anxiety in children. They don't know what to do with themselves, and they don't know how to look after themselves.
Hi, Anna. We've heard a lot from our callers today who have big families, and there seems to be this built-in independence that comes with a bigger family because parents can't keep an eye on all of them and micromanage. Michael, I think, alluded to it, that we are smaller families now. Is that part of the issue here?
I think so, definitely. Yes, I do. Yeah, I do think that's part of the issue. I think when you've only got one child in one home, and I think, I mean, it's a complexity of issues. It's also the fact that our neighbourhoods, our kids' horizons have shrunk. They don't have their neighbourhoods anymore to play with. The backyard is declining. There's indoor spaces as well now, just children's entertainment areas just for kids, and they can sit in there quietly and play with screens the entire day, and a whole childhood could go by without unnoticed, unheard of. It's a silent disruptor. And then you've got all the fear, you know, surrounding and the 24-hour news cycle that we're all constantly fed, fear day in, day out. So it's a plethora of issues. And children, again, now I think what we're also seeing, we've got all these external barriers to kids having that independence and that play. But now you've got this internal barrier in the child where they actually have no value for that type of play because they have a lack of experience with it. So in that child's brain, it doesn't have any value or meaning. So I think one of those best protective factors that we can do for our children is make sure they have those huge outdoor play files, independent play files in their brains that they're building, and it will drive them and motivate them to want more. But I think also with children, if they're not connected with other children in their neighbourhoods and they're not able to be independently motivated to go and connect with other kids, then they won't do it. If a child perceives 30% chance, I think it is, that if they walk out their front door and they're not able to see another child out there, then they won't go.
And that's an important point. Rachel, I know in my circumstance, I live in the inner city of Brisbane, and I'm quite happy for my son to be free range. He's old enough and responsible enough to do so. But it's actually other parents who aren't so keen, which makes it a little tougher then for him to be as free range as I'd like him to be.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And as Michael pointed out, with smaller families, this is only going to become more and more the norm. It's certainly much easier in rural areas where everyone knows everyone and everyone knows where the kids are and in what street and that kind of thing. But I suppose what you can do in inner city is think about, you know, where's your local park, meeting up with people down there. You know, I even take my baby to a little singing group at the library. I know it's not outdoors, but he gets to, you know, see other babies, which is fascinating for him. And there are often little things on, little play groups, little community groups, and you can start there. And once you start to build a network of interested people, you can then meet with those people down at the beach, parks later on. And I think, Hayani, you try and encourage that with nature play, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of getting actual groups of people in various areas together to meet up and sort of play outdoors with their kids.
Yeah, definitely. We're actually in the middle of making a documentary on neighbourhood play. We're working with a couple of neighbourhoods in Caboolture. And we're trying to support two mums who've got kids to activate their streets and places as neighbourhoods for kids to play, where they can walk out their front door. And it takes effort and it takes time. As a society, we've become quite isolated. I think I've heard someone call our suburbs a bunch of dormitories, not a community. You know, so we're just encased in these boxes. And our kids' experiences of their neighbourhoods are through car windows, not through direct connection, walking around their streets and having intimate. I'm now, as a child, for myself, I knew every single part of my neighbourhood. I knew where all the best gutters were, where you could drive around, ride my push bike and do great jumps off of.
In fact, you took great pride, I remember, as a kid, in knowing all the shortcuts,
exactly,
all the most exciting spots to hang with your other friends.
It was where the best trees were to make
exactly. The
awesome cubby houses.
That's it. Well, unfortunately, there aren't that too many of those sort of spaces available in the inner city. Let's go to Peter. He's called in from Logan Central. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Very well. Yeah, I like a lot of the things I'm hearing from people. Firstly, what I believe is very true is this, is that children all want to be adults. So you have a great opportunity to encourage your child with great ease, because they want to be just like you. So how you behave is how they're going to behave as well. So if you pay attention to them, and you help them through learning to be just like you, then they'll do almost anything. that you do. But if you say, I hate cleaning, I hate doing this, I hate doing that, and you demand the child do it because it's an awful job, then they're just going to respond in the same way. I hate doing this.
That's a fair point. What about the point that Hayano made about the fact that they have to learn the skills of playing outside? If it's not sort of standard play, then it's sort of not in their repertoire.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's why it's really important for parents to spend time with their children instead of trying to put them with other people, because the parents can take them through all those events that are important. We've actually put education on its head, and we've said that universities are where people learn things, but they do learn certain things there, but it's as children that they learn the most important things. And you can take them out into the environment, and I mean the built environment or the natural environment, and you can talk to them about what the trees are there, what the names are. I have a whole program I've done, actually, which I did with my child for 9 years while she was growing up, and I homeschooled her for 9 years, and she's very capable and successful as a result. She's living completely independently. In fact, when it was time for her to go to university, I just dropped her off, and she sorted everything out for herself and went right ahead, and I actually went travelling overseas for a while.
Oh, lucky you. Well, it sounds like you did a few things right there, Peter. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Okay.
Great to hear from you. You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane. The time is 11:15. I'm Cathy Van Exel, filling in for Emma Griffiths this week. And today we're talking about how to encourage your children to be independent. We have an SMS message. Surely the positive aspects of free-range child's play lay simply in our evolution. Our ancestors must have been wired learning from being outside doing their own thing. That would mean it is intrinsic. That's a comment from Sean from Tenerife. Picking up on Peter's call where he mentioned that he has homeschooled his daughter for 9 years, sounds like with great success. Joining me in the studio now is Jennifer Haynes, who's the principal of the Brisbane Independent School. And with her is a student from BIS, Charlotte, who's 11. Hello and welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Now, first of all, I'll talk to you first, Jen, about Brisbane Independent School. It's about encouraging some of these ways to become more independent in play and in learning. Can you explain a little bit about why that's important in a schooling environment?
Sure. So the school's been around for 50 years this year, and over that time we've tried lots of different models to specifically help an individual learn how to be able to build skills and feel confident to be able to affect the change they want to make on the world as an adult. That's the intention. And the reason that that's important is because otherwise, you know, you're sitting there as a citizen of the world as an adult who doesn't know how to be able to help make the world a better place.
My child goes to a state school, and it's a very structured environment, and it's become very risk averse, much more risk averse than I remember as a kid, to the point where, you know, the goals are covered in padding, kids aren't allowed to climb the trees, they're not allowed to build structures in under the trees. Is there a problem here with litigation, or is it the fear of litigation that's sort of driving some of this?
I think there's not litigation in Australia in relation to schooling isn't a huge issue. There's an inherent risk in schooling. Everyone knows that. But you do have to make sure that you're taking basic responsibility. Like, one of the key features of being able to allow children to make choices for themselves is the boundaries have to be really clear. They shouldn't be testing to know whether or not something is going to be deadly to them. Right? That's an adult's responsibility. What they should be doing is testing how to be able to make something work the way they want it to be able to work. That's where the real challenge and the courageous kind of learning comes from, is that process.
So can you give us an example of how that might apply at BIS?
I'll give you a great example. So we have a whole strand of our learning that's called Omni Projects, which is all about allowing kids to develop a set of skills that they have shown us that they really want to be able to build. So that includes the one I do, which is cooking skills, bush skills, how to be able to make presentations, craft, sewing, digital and electronics. There's lots of them. I'm forgetting them all. All sorts of things. And there's about six or seven kids in a group with an adult. And we work with them for 6 weeks on learning specific skills, and then for the last 4 weeks, they use those skills to create their own project. So it's terrifying as an adult. As an adult, as a teacher, and, you know, as a mother, it was just as scary, but not as many kids, when you're helping them learn how to use a sharp knife or how to be able to use a hot plate. And a six-year-old with a sharp knife is a scary thing.
Right? Very much.
Yeah, but not when they learn to use it, and not when they learn the dangers of it, and not when they learn that the purpose of it is to actually create and to make. That's where it becomes a super powerful process. So the idea of the Omni strand is for them to be able to learn those skills so that they can just use them whenever they need to, and that they'll go through each of these learning processes twice in their time at BIS. So by the time they graduate, they should be really competent in them. And then their final project at the end of the year, they can choose whatever they want to be able to do their final project. And that's one of our learning strands.
Charlotte, you're 11 years old.
Yeah.
Tell me about one of the scariest things you've done so far. Have you done the Omni project?
Yeah, I've done the Omni project. I've been at BIS for 3 years, and we've been doing a lot of different Omni projects. I did a wide range of Omni projects, from electronics to cooking, and it was very interesting and kind of scary too.
So those sharp knives, how did you master them?
Well, if you under proper guidance, I guess. So being taught how to use them properly, and so I can use it at home as well, not just at school.
And do you surprise your parents when you come home with some new skills that you've learnt that way?
Sometimes.
What do you think, does it make you feel more confident about things, being able to, try things out in this sort of environment?
Yeah, I think it's really easy because it's a flexible environment, and we're able to make mistakes and retrace and then make mistakes again, and being able to be okay with if you fail, because it means that you tried something and didn't get it quite right the first time, and you can try it again and again.
So that's a great attitude to failure. It's a learning lesson.
Always. Yeah.
And what about other kids? Do you find that you help each other?
Sometimes. It's very important that everybody else is kind of supportive and not giving up as well. So if you're not giving up, then other people won't too. So it's...
Charlotte, that's some great advice that the adults could take on as well. Jen, we've talked about playing outside a lot this morning, and the benefit of playing outside and creating those life skills. I want to ask you about how do you encourage independent thought in this process? Is that something that BIS does?
Oh, absolutely. It's something we actually track kids in their development over. So if you're following children's developmental needs, independent thought means something really different at each of those stages. So that's one thing. Just like freedom of choice means something really different at each of those stages of development too. But independent thought comes from full confidence in the fact that you're allowed to be able to say no. That's inherent in it. All of our classrooms have a stop, I don't like it rule in it, and they can apply that to an adult or a child. Ultimately, if there's something that someone asks you to do, you're allowed to say, no, I don't want to do that. That's a key feature of independent thought, as is the willingness to take a risk for it to fail and it to be embarrassing. So a key part of our study of self unit is the children learning how to be able to take those kind of risks and get a bit embarrassed, and everyone supports them in it. We don't laugh at each other, unless we're supposed to, right, Charlie?
Yeah.
because otherwise that defeats the purpose. And in those really early stages of your development, when you're around 8 or 9, you're forming a story of yourself that will stay with you for the rest of your life.
I'm wondering how this applies in the real world once the kids move on from this. If you've been in an environment where you've been supported in failure and been encouraged to learn from mistakes, how that fits in what can be a pretty brutal society at times.
Yeah, it can. Part of the high school prep program, which Charlotte's going through right now, is getting them ready for what that's going to be like, because it can be a really big change. We also advise parents to make sure that they, you know, go to after school opportunities like sports groups and those type of things as well. But being able to learn how to fail and have support around it should be something you can maintain no matter where you are in life. If you move to a high school environment, don't make friends with a group of kids who are all going to laugh at you when you fail. Just don't. Find a group of kids who aren't. There are groups of kids that are not going to laugh at you when you fail. So being able to actually know what is a good friend for you and a good support for you is a key practice to develop all the way through your childhood and adolescence.
And that's a role that a parent can play, at least in
guiding. Definitely, definitely, yep.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic program. And Charlotte, sounds like you have lots of fun at school.
Yeah.
Lucky you. Thanks very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure to hear your story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jen Haynes is the principal of the Brisbane Independent School, and one of the students is Charlotte, who's 11 and a very confident young woman. Now you're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane. The time is 6 minutes to 11. Hayano, let's talk about this idea of, where you transition from a supportive family environment to the real world. What's important then in terms of, building on or helping children become more independent for that sort of more rugged environment that they can move into?
I suppose as parents, the role that we can play in helping our kids develop that independence is it's a different type of role. It's that being that enchanter. Being able to throw seeds, being that observer, watching our kids' skill levels, so we know we're not letting them jump into tasks that might actually put them at real risk, but also not being afraid to let our kids get hurt, to a certain degree, because failure is a great teacher. I suppose it's also prioritizing play in our kids' lives, scheduling in unscheduled time, letting our kids be the directors, the determiners of what they do, and letting them run the activity. And as a parent, the other role that we can take is being the connector. So it's our job to hunt for those kids in your community, in your neighbourhood, and break down the barriers with those parents. Go and talk to them, have a cuppa, let the kids play while you're doing it, and build that trust, because the more we get to know our neighbours and connect with them, the more safer our neighbourhoods start to feel.
Absolutely. But
a lot of it is around that uncertainty.
Rachel, Hayano talked there about parents being the connector. I think from my experience, at least with a lot of families, parents are often the social and entertainment directors when they're busy sort of going from one activity to the other, whether it's sports lessons, music lessons, piano lessons, I don't know. There's all sorts of lessons that we all feel that we need to be enrolled in. Are we too structured or are we being too structured in our approach to our child's learning and our child's play?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong with structured sports and all that sort of stuff. All of my kids have been involved in various sports, and it's great for health and fitness and camaraderie and teamwork. And in fact, you learn quite a few life lessons yourself on a rugby field, for example. You screw up, you get a yellow card. These are good life lessons to learn going forward. So there's nothing bad about that at all. But certainly giving children the opportunity to develop their problem-solving skills, their own creative imagination within that unstructured environment is just as important. So it's great that kids are getting out there and meeting other kids, on a field or in team sports, etc. But also getting out there just down the local park and catching up with those kids and doing their own thing in their own time is equally as important.
So it's about carving out time for that unstructured play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, the point you made earlier about transitioning into the workforce and transitioning into uni, I'm always fascinated when I'm confronted by a university student, usually first years, when they get their first fail. And it's really interesting seeing the difference between a student who comes in and says, I failed, what did I do wrong, how can I get better, versus, unfortunately, the majority in this generation who come in and say, I got a fail, can you regrade my work?
Mm. So, or get their parent to call.
They can't at university. We're very lucky because they're 18. So we're very lucky we don't have the school's problem with that. But, what are you actually saying to me here? You failed and now you'd like me to give you some false feedback.
Are you serious? How do you think you're going to go in a workplace if that's your attitude? You are going to be let go very, very quickly. So that unwillingness to learn, that unwillingness to face, you know, perhaps a difficult truth about your performance and to actually capitalise on that to do better is a very, very serious problem in this generation.
And I'd like to just very briefly, because time is now against us, very briefly, Hayano, raise the question around the law, because there is a law in Queensland, at least, where you're not meant to leave your child unsupervised for a reasonable amount of time.
I'm pretty sure it's under 12.
Under 12.
Under 12 years of age, yeah.
And so that makes it a bit of a dampener for parents, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's to think that it's illegal for your children to play and connect with other children, that's on their independently, that's a big structural issue we've got.
It's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your calls today as well. We've been listening to Hayano Moser and Rachel Sharman, who are two experts on the independence of children. I'm Cathy Van Extel, and I'm filling in for Emma Griffiths this week. Thank you very much for looking after me.